Good morning. I was about to say good evening, and then I realized, no, it's still morning. Good morning. Welcome to our session. I am Pamela Sherman, an HR business partner and the head of diversity and inclusion at Applied Materials. We are a proud sponsor of the Texas Conference for Women, and actually we have 100 employees here today. So, woohoo! So Applied Materials, my tribe, is here. Applied Materials is the leader in materials engineering solutions used to produce virtually every chip and advanced display in the world. We believe that diversity and inclusion helps to fuel innovation and are essential to our vision to make possible the technology that shapes the future. Applied Materials is committed to fostering a culture where all team members know that they are safe, welcomed, valued, respected, as we work together to solve problems that create opportunities for all. So today's session is particularly important. With that, I would like to introduce the moderator, Emily Ramshaw. Emily is the editor-in-chief. Yeah, round of applause for Emily. Emily is the editor-in-chief of the Texas Tribune. Under her leadership, the Tribune has won several awards. And also, Emily serves on the board of the Pulitzer Prize. And with that, I'm going to turn over our panel and our session to Emily.
Great. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for this incredibly important conversation. In the wake of Me Too, what does the workplace look like now? As Pam said, I'm Emily Ramshaw, editor of the Tribune, and I'm a newsroom leader who's been doing a lot of soul searching in the last several months to make sure my workplace is a place where people feel safe and protected from sexual harassment and misconduct, and learning from leaders like these two folks. I'm honored to get to moderate what I'm sure is really going to be an informative session with two true leaders in this space. On my immediate left, Nina Shaw is a highly respected entertainment lawyer and co-founder of Time's Up, which works to improve laws, employment agreements, and corporate policies addressing sexual harassment in the workplace, and to help more women and men access the legal system to hold wrongdoers accountable. She's been named repeatedly to the Hollywood Reporter's Women in Entertainment Power 100 list, and in 2013 was named Entertainment Lawyer of the Year by the Beverly Hills Bar Association. More recently, she was honored by Essence Magazine with its 2016 Black Women in Hollywood Power Award. Please join me in welcoming Nina Shaw. And Dr. David Smith, the man brave enough to be on stage with us today, is an Dr. Smith is an associate professor of sociology in the Department of National Security Affairs at the United States Naval War College and co-author of the book Athena Rising: How and Why Men Should Mentor Women. He's a former Navy pilot who flew combat missions in Iraq and Afghanistan, and a sociologist who focuses his research on gender, work, and family issues, including women in the military and the retention of women in the workplace. Again, big round of applause for these two panelists. So I'm going to do just a little bit of stage setting, a little bit of context before we launch into this conversation. I want to give you the lay of the land. It's been 1 year and 1 month, which is amazing, since the New York Times and the New Yorker broke the initial stories on Harvey Weinstein that took down the whole house of cards of prominent men engaging in sexual assault, sexual harassment, and even worse, in the workplace. In that time, huge companies have changed their policies, bringing years of sweeping sexual harassment under the rug out into the open. States like California and New York have passed laws to help combat workplace harassment and to make anti-harassment training mandatory. And the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has released data showing sexual harassment complaints filed with it this past fiscal year rose by more than 12% over 2017 figures. But there's still a long way to go. Many of the first legal cases filed in the Me Too era are just now making their way to court, and it's unclear which way they'll go. We've also started to see a backlash in the workplace of some men being afraid to mentor women or invite them on business trips, leading to fears that women could be professionally held back. Just last week, the New York Times reported that Google paid a top executive $90 million on the way out the door while keeping quiet allegations of sexual misconduct the company had found to be credible. And though women's allegations are believed to be taken more seriously than they were before, the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court confirmation sent many women a far different message and stirred up a lot of feelings for women on both sides of the aisle. So with that, I'm going to launch into a line of questioning with these two, and we are going to wrap up a little bit early to give you all ample times for question at the end, so make sure you're coming up with your great ideas. I want to just ask you both, a stage setter, Nina, David, is the workplace a safer place, a more just place for women today than it was a year ago? Nina, why don't you kick off?
It is certainly an improved place. I think that women are much more empowered, and I think men and other abusers of power, and let's be really clear about that. We use terms like sexual harassment. We're really talking about is a group of powerful people attempting to exert their will on a group of people who they perceive as being less powerful. So to the extent that women and other marginalized people, and I know it's mainly associated with women, but these abuses are not happening to just women, they're happening to people of all kinds. To the extent that we are taking our agency, we are standing up for ourselves, I think the workplace is an improved place in that sense. It is also a far more confusing place, because as we're undergoing a great cultural shift, this is something you've talked about a great deal in your work, we are seeing people not being quite clear where they fit in and what their roles are. And I think that's a little bit of the backlash that you're talking about. I think of it less as backlash and more as the uneasiness of cultural change and the adjustment to new roles in the culture.
David.
Good morning, everyone. And I would agree. I think it is a more just place. I think we're moving in that direction. I think one of the challenges is that as a social scientist, I look at this, I want to see the evidence that goes with this. And certainly reporting around sexual assault and sexual harassment, we know, is one of the most underreported crimes out there today. So it's challenging to find that. And what does it mean to see an increase, right, in reporting of sexual harassment? Does that mean that we're finding that it's easier to report? That would be a good sign. Or is there more? Is there still lots more going on? So I think there's some conflicting evidence as we look at this, and that's always a challenge out there. But I agree with Nina that I think a lot of this is really about the changing of the rules of the workplace that has been for so many years a masculine-dominated workplace that's structured by men for men, and that's shifting. That's changing finally, and I think that's what's causing this shift in uneasiness and certainly the rules out there today.
Well, let's get into some of those specifics. I mean, I asked you both if the workplace is safer and more just for women. How specifically have you seen workplaces nationally changing in the last year? Policies that they're putting into effect, actual, you know, procedural ways that women are safer or more respected?
Well, I think the legislative changes, which are, you know, state by state and therefore different in different places, are things that you're all hearing about. You're hearing about the attempts to change statute of limitations to allow victims greater or survivors greater time to bring their claims. We're talking about the not asking people to sign non-disclosures, not asking people to mediate, be forced to mediate these kinds of claims. Those are all things. In both California and New York, and I'm sure some other jurisdictions, we have laws that now prohibit you from asking anyone what their salary was in an attempt to have people not be bound by precedent, by a salary history that unfairly stigmatizes them because they were paid on an inequitable basis. So those are all the kinds of changes that I would point to as real changes. But there is also, as I see it, and this is anecdotal, and David's work is really much more based in the specifics, is that I do still see a great deal of retaliation and a great deal of fear of retaliation, which might as well be retaliation itself. Because if you're afraid to speak up because you're going to be retaliated against, then it's the same impact. And that is still, I think, a great deal, perhaps less so in my own personal work, but more so, I think, in the areas and fields that are really, that we don't talk about enough. We don't talk about people who work in the fast food industry. We talk somewhat more about women in the military and the challenges that they've faced. But we are finding in the Times Up Legal Defense Fund that our clients, the people who have come to us seeking aid, span 60 different occupations. So we're talking about a very widespread systemic problem.
I would add to that, I had a conversation recently with a company where they we're looking for alternate ways. Again, we don't have enough legislation today, really, at the federal or the state level to really oversee a lot of this. So companies are taking it upon themselves in many cases to find other ways to solve this, because it's a business imperative for their people right now to do this, and finding kind of alternate routes to handle these before things go to HR, right? I think ultimately HR is still in the line there of where it's getting resolved, but trying to find other ways to have these conversations, I think, around what's going on, what happened, and can we resolve it in a different way. The other thing that I think is really interesting, kind of in between, is how unions are getting activated. And, you know, a colleague and peer of ours, LaFonza Butler in California in particular, you know, doing incredible work out there, working with large unions today to, again, enact policy and law to protect people that don't necessarily have a voice in the same way that a lot of us do in other organizations.
David, I want to ask you about the possible unintended consequences of this movement. A Pew Research Center poll this year found that 51% of Americans believe the increased focus on sexual harassment and sexual assault has made it more difficult for men to know how to interact with women at work. Is it possible that women will find fewer opportunities for networking and promotion because men are just scared?
Certainly, and certainly there's evidence. You know, Sheryl Sandberg with Lean In recently did they had a survey out there and asking men that exact question. And again, we saw a significant increase in the number of men who are like, yeah, less likely to get involved in any sort of a professional relationship with women at work. And it's interesting, you know, we were working on this a few years before, again, Me Too became, you know, such a great social trajectory for us right now, that we found that there were a lot of these reasons where men were already reluctant to be engaged in professional relationships with women at work. And there were so many that we called them the reluctant male syndrome. And we, you know, we can laugh about it, but there, I think this is the conversation that my co-author Brad Johnson and I are trying to have with men in the workplace today, is we need to talk about these things. We are not going to affect change without talking about them and understanding the reasons why these, whether it's unconscious bias in the way that we perceive our female colleagues at work, and she's not leader potential, she's not strong enough to handle it, right, and how that limits our ability to engage with women, or whether it's just the anxiety that we might have around interacting with women at work, because, gosh, you know, I grew up and I had a relationship with my mom and other female members of my family, and I know what that looks like, but the fact that I, you know, wasn't given a script to understand what does a relationship look like with a woman at work, some men get really anxious about that. And what do? When we're anxious, we avoid. And that's not the solution, right? The solution is exposure, right? So from the psychological perspective, exposure therapy is what we want, right? More interaction and learning how to do that in a positive way. And finally, the perceptions piece is always there, right? A concern about what are people going to say, what are people going to think if I suddenly start having this professional relationship with women at work. So there were already a host of reasons out there. And then Me Too just gave men another, I'll just call it an excuse, right, to leverage those even more so.
Yeah, a plug for David's book. I read it before this panel, and there's like a whole chapter at the end that's basically like, hey, for you men who feel like you're creeping on women at work, here's how not to be creepy. It's like, you know, amazing that they need a guide, but it's a pretty terrific guide, so you should read it. Nina, a recent Time magazine poll found that 60% of women say the environment for women in their workplace has not changed since Me Too. How should employees, how can women in this room be forcing the issue in their workplace if their managers aren't taking it seriously?
I think, again, something I mentioned in the earlier keynote this morning, I think that solidarity among women at work is really the key to it. Solidarity, and I would say transparency. Often you find when you are having a problem, it is not a problem that is unique to you. And once you find that that problem is not unique to you, then you know that that problem is not because of you. And once you know that problem is not because of you, then you can work to try to figure out how to solve that problem. So I really do encourage women, and especially women early in their career, and also women kind of caught in the middle, talk to your peers. There's just this tremendous emphasis in business about mentorship. And mentorship is important, and mentorship has its place. But the other thing that has its place is solidarity, that being aligned with people whose interests, even if you don't perceive those interests as being the same, they are the same. because you're all trying to do your work in a place that is safe and comfortable, and it allows you to do it to the best of your ability. So I would believe, I absolutely understand that, Paul, and I think it's especially true for women who work in areas like the fast food industry, like retail, where other people get to control their time and their schedule, and often do it in a way that retaliates against them when they attempt to assert their rights. Well, that's only going to change if they all band together to emphasize to management that they are being retaliated against.
I think this conversation about low-income women is obviously very important because you do see a lot of reporting, well, you know, now supermodels have private rooms to change in, and now, you know, celebrities have these different protections in place, and it is just, that's such an important reminder that this affects, disparately affects, you know, women of color, women who are low-income, and they aren't often, you know, part of the headlines.
Right, and even in our business, the entertainment business, a significant number of women work in what we call the below-the-line and the crafts and the industries. And one of the things that we found, for example, is that if you're in a craft that is female-dominated, like hair, like makeup, you are traditionally paid less than men who are in crafts where they set design. So the more men you find in a craft, even in an industry like ours, the higher the wages will be, even in a unionized setting. So there's just something endemic to our system that values the work of women less, and unless we stand up and ask for it to be valued more, it's not going to happen.
What are the biggest corporate success stories you all are seeing? What are the big companies out there that have really moved the needle that should be models for the rest of the country in the last year?
So it's interesting, you know, I often get asked about the military side of this, and I'll just quick give a plug and that we don't get it right all the time. There's a lot of good people trying to get it right, and it's interesting, there was a story in the news the other day, the Marine Corps having to give updates on the Marines United Facebook scandal, and the four-star general was reporting back to Congress and explaining to them about how they were handling accountability for the perpetrators, and as well as the things that were being put in place to change the culture. And it was really interesting. He thought it was, I think, kind of a side comment the general made about the fact that what's really interesting is the fact that we're seeing not just women report more harassment in the Marine Corps, but we found about a small percentage of men out there now that's different. We didn't have before, and there was about, he said, I don't know if it was an exact number or not, but he says about 8%. And I go, well, that's a marked difference, because if you think about every company out there, if we had 8% of these, and I would call them male allies in particular, right, guys who understand and can see what's going on and then do something about it, right, so they understand it and they actually do something, publicly advocate, that I think that's important to see some of those. And we're seeing more and more of that now, I think, as we begin to engage in this conversation out there around it.
Nina, any thoughts on who's doing it well, who's doing it best?
I don't think anyone is doing it as well as they could, but I think that a lot of people are trying, and I think that's so important in this environment. One person who comes to mind, and I'm so sorry because I think it's Flynn at PricewaterhouseCooper, who's been really at the forefront of gathering Fortune 500 CEOs and asking them to really look at issues of diversity and inclusion, and who's put quite a bit of PwC's money into these ventures. I think until we have leadership at the very, very top saying, this is important to me, then it's not going to become a priority within companies. So when I look at him, I think of him as someone who is a good example of someone who is attempting to lead and really staking his claim and saying, this is important. PwC being a diverse and inclusive society is important to the future of our company. We will be a better company. We will all make more money. And we will, at the end of the day, service our clients in a more comprehensive and full way. So I think that's...
I want to ask you both, you know, the Me Too movement was going so strong, and I think a lot of women were feeling like for the first time their voices were really being heard and that they were being believed. And then the Brett Kavanaugh hearings came around, and I think for a lot of women that was just a gut-wrenching experience because they felt like suddenly a woman was no longer being believed at the very highest levels. What has that whole experience and the sort of emotions that it has wrought on both sides of the aisle meant for the Me Too movement?
You know, it's so funny. Many of you know or may not know, Anita Hill and I have been lifelong friends since we were law students and worked together in our first summer clerkship. And so the day of the hearings, you know, we're furiously texting each other and talking about it afterwards. And then after the hearings, I spoke to her and I said, aside from the fact that the PTSD of 27 years ago, which she freely admitted to, she was actually enormously hopeful because she said something to me that really resonated. She said, you know, Nina, it's never easy. We always see these movements from the perspective of time. We're looking back at them, but we're not necessarily in them. And there were always, in every movement, tremendous setbacks. And what those setbacks did is that they motivated people to keep moving forward. So had this sailed through, there might have been people who said, as they did in the Obama administration, that we were post-racial, which clearly we're not.
Spoiler alert.
But, yes, as a former student of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it was disheartening for me personally, but I can tell you that it only motivated us, and I think we saw that in many ways in the elections, because women ran. They didn't always win, but they ran, and there was an urgency in their running. I love the fact, I think Katie Hill, who ran in a formerly heavily Republican and won in California, said something to me. She said, when I first met her, I said, what made you decide to run? She said, I said, somebody should run. Somebody should make change. And then she said, you know what? That somebody should be me. And I do think that that's the difference.
Yep. David, President Trump said recently in response to the Kavanaugh hearings that it's, quote, a very scary time for young men in America. Is it a very scary time for young men in America?
So, if you're a perpetrator, yes. You know, I say that a little tongue-in-cheek, but I am serious about that. If you're a perpetrator, yes, and it should be a scary time for you. And I hope you're found. And I hope we rid them of the workplace as fast as humanly possible. But for everybody else, for the rest of the guys out there, it shouldn't be. I think we're back to this, again, the shifting dynamics that are changing the culture and the workplace, and that's anxiety producing. So I think that scary is interpreted as a little bit of anxiety that guys have about, gosh, I don't know, the rules of the workplace have changed suddenly. And it's like, well, how do we get past that? And it's, you know, as Nina said, it's a lot about a dialogue. It's a conversation that we need to have around gender partnership in the workplace. And not so much about just men in the workplace. And so, yes, I think it is a scary time if you're a perpetrator out there, and as it should be. But for the rest, no. I think this is a time for us to begin to have a dialogue and to have a conversation, and we can begin to move on and make real change.
Yeah, and if I could just add one thing to it. You want to talk about scary times, and I don't want to ever diminish any mother's concern about their child. But I know what it has been like for me as a woman of color, and I always feel so uneasy about the fact that a lot of times when my friends and younger women of color I know have boys, there's this moment of you know, what, as you always feel about a child, but then there's the next thing that always pops in our heads. Is something going to happen to him? And that's really scary. This notion that you look at a newborn and you project, and it is projection, but it's projection that is based in part in reality. So while I don't want to diminish those people who genuinely are concerned for their children, because what kind of a mother would I be if I did that? I also want to point out to them that there are those of us who don't sleep until our kids pull into the driveway, who worry about them incessantly. I told someone that sometimes when I see groups of young black men in particular at the mall or on the street, I will sometimes stop and watch them, not because I'm afraid of them, I'm afraid for them. I will sometimes just watch them because I'm afraid that someone is going to accuse them or something, that they're going to be a little bit too loud and a little bit too, in the way that all teenagers are, but that's going to be interpreted in a negative. So one of the things that when the president said that, I thought to myself, what a slap in the face to all those women who bury their sons for no reasons at all. That's what I think we need to be more worried about.
David, I want to ask you, you've been doing a lot of research about male allies and male mentorship. I'm a woman who's absolutely the beneficiary of male mentorship. I had an incredible CEO who gave me great opportunities, probably well before I was ready for it. Talk about the importance of male mentorship in that space. What role do men play in changing this dialogue? What should they be doing specifically?
So, two things. One is we think about allyship. I think there's two parts to this. One is we have to think about our own individual responsibility and accountability for our own actions and words and behavior in the workplace. And certainly that's a place to start, that we have to take our ownership of that. And then as well as think about how are we being supportive, collaborative peers and colleagues in the workplace and the same way that we do for men. And I think men have to begin to think about that. But then there's the other half of it. That's just the first part. You have to have the public advocacy piece of this, right? You have to be, you've got to walk the talk. You got to show you have some skin in the game here, and you've got to be a public advocate for this. And I think that's the more challenging part, but we have to start somewhere. And, you know, one of the things that we know about male allies and men acting as allies, and just allies broadly, is that we have to start with listening, and we have to start with learning and understanding the experiences of others who are not like ourselves. And so begin to check your own privilege when you enter a space and you're working with people. And first, that learning and understanding will then allow you to connect with people and understand the barriers and challenges that may be different. Just finished Dolly Chug's new book, The Person You Mean to Be, and she talks a lot about, you know, the concepts of headwinds and tailwinds. And I think that's a great way to think about how, you know, privilege plays out in terms of, a tailwind for some of us and maybe a headwind for others in that way. And so we have to be able to connect to that. And I think the personal connection is important, too. And we know that good allies have some sort of there's a connection with one of their colleagues or a family member, somebody that really gives you that personal motivation and commitment, all right, to doing the work out there and then going out there and doing that. Showing the commitment, the sense of fairness and justice for everyone in the workplace. So I think it's important. Men have got to be part of the solution because we're part of the problem. And if we're going to move the dial on inclusion in particular in the workplace, men have got to be part of it. And certainly the research bears this out as well, that we know that in companies that are doing a good job of reporting about how well they're succeeding or failing around these types of initiatives, that when men are engaged in diversity initiatives broadly, they have a really high success rate, about 96%. And when they're not, it's really low. So we know that that's part of the solution here, is that we have to get men engaged in this conversation.
Nina, what should we expect to see from Time's Up, which has raised more than $20 million so far to provide legal resources to women in the workplace and recently hired its first president and CEO? Where is the movement headed?
If you had told me a year ago, as we sat in those conference rooms on a daily basis and plotted and planned this, that I would be sitting here today, $22 million later, I just wouldn't have believed you. The need was so great in the marketplace in the world, in the culture, for women to come together in the way that we did. But now that we're having done so, we're very, very much focused on the future, very much focused on institutionalizing ourselves. Lisa Borders, who you spoke of, former president of the WNBA, former president of the Atlanta City Council, executive at Coca-Cola, has become our first CEO, and she is just a dynamo. And we will be announcing other changes and other increases in our infrastructure so that we can be much more effective in reaching people of all kinds. We often say at Time's Up, we're not looking to replace a patriarchy with a matriarchy. We're looking to figure out a way that everyone can come together and be better off because we can be our true authentic selves in the workplace. And that's why, thanks so much, and please read David's book because I was just like furiously reading it at night. It is so good and it is so important in terms of the place that men have to play in this. And you know what? It's good for men. And that's something that I think keeps getting lost. There's always this kind of zero-sum game of you're going to give up something and you're going to lose. Not you're going to give up something and you're going to get something even better. Because imagine if you're a man and the pit in your stomach every day of all the responsibility that is constantly on you. Yeah, there's a lot of privilege that comes with it, but there's a lot of bad stuff that comes with it, and we see it. We see it in their health issues. We see it in their, you know, their relationships with their spouses and their sons, and this has not been good. Much of the way this has been structured has not been good for anyone, and that's what we at Time's Up want to address. How are we going to shift the culture in such a way that we can all go forward together and be better people for it? So you're going to hear a lot from us in this coming year. I'm asking all of you, go to our website, read our material, sign up, you know, give us suggestions. This is a place where we say in Time's Up, if you have an idea, give us that idea and then tell us about how you're going to be part of implementing it. So you're all invited.
You talk about this being good for men, and I want to read this amazing quote from David's book that says, of men, rewarded from birth merely for owning a penis, we are all silent beneficiaries or whistling bystanders in a world that persists in keeping women on the sidelines. Gentlemen, this is a call to arms. Why do men benefit from the mentorship of women, and is that in jeopardy in light of the Me Too movement?
Well, it is if men are running for the hills, right, and they're headed up for the sidelines and not engaging in professional relationships with women. I think that is a risk that we have, but I would like to, you know, talk about the positive side of it. As Dina said, there are a lot of great benefits to it, and I think this is one of the stories that we try to get out, and we're working with different organizations out there, is that, you know, and it's not just men mentoring women, by the way. It's men, and we advocate for this as well, is that men should be mentored by women. You should have just as many women in your mentoring network, not just one mentor, but lots of mentors, and women should be a part of that, both as your mentors and as your mentees. And the reason this works is, it's the same way for everybody else, is that it increases the access to information, right, of knowledge of different parts of the organization that you wouldn't otherwise have, because you have this more diverse, broader network across your organization. So you're more effective as a leader. And I think that's really important because as we think about this, this is not a women's issue. This is a leadership issue. This is something that we, as leaders of organizations, we have to take ownership of it and begin to engage in this way. And the final thing that I think, Nina, that you brought up was about, again, how it affects relationships. And the great thing about research is that it shows that we find that men have more enhanced interpersonal skills when they are mentoring women or mentored by women. Okay, so higher EQ, and that's great in the workplace. Who wouldn't want that? And it also translates into the home. And I think that's just a great win-win-win for everybody.
Well, I want to pivot to a little bit of practical advice for this room. You know, statistically speaking, there are people in this room who've experienced sexual harassment in the workplace, and probably statistically speaking, there are women in this room who have not felt comfortable bringing that to the attention of supervisors or management. From an employee perspective, if you've experienced or witnessed harassment, what should your first stop be? Should it be HR? Should it be confronting that individual? I mean, how do you advise people in the workplace?
We actually have, I'll speak briefly to this, but if you go to the Time's Up website, we actually have a document that explains how you should approach if you feel that you have been harassed in the workplace for whatever reason, or whatever form of harassment I meant. You know, first and foremost, document. There's a tendency to not trust your own, like, did that happen? write it down and write it in a place that you have access to, and that access cannot be taken away from you. So that means do not keep those notes in your office computer, or solely in your office computer, or not in your office computer at all, because your office computer is property of your employer and they have access to it. Speak to others, not in a, in a necessarily in an accusatory way, but just to get a sense of your of what's going on. Because, like I said, it's very rare that just one person gets targeted. This tends; these problems always tend to, you know, it's so funny. I tell people this all the time when they say, "Oh my gosh, so and so, I heard he did this, and then he was gone." And what they don't know is, they heard he did this. We at Time's Up have often heard about the other 12 things that happened. And that's the reason why that person not was so much pushed out the door, but ran out the door. And then I would also say that HR departments are becoming better. I really do believe that. And they're becoming more accountable to the employees as well as the employer, but that's not across the board. So take a realistic assessment of the HR environment in your workplace. And if it's not a supportive environment, if it's an environment that you think is really there just to support the employer, then maybe it's not the place you go. But if there is a real protocol and a clear way to go about this, then take advantage of that. But document, document, document. You know?
And what do you do if you're in a very small company and there is no HR department? I mean, what are your resources then?
It's that is something that we face all the time in the entertainment industry, because so much of the work happens in these distant locations on sets where there's really almost sometimes no one in charge. And we are trying, in having formed the Hollywood Commission with Anita Hill and Kathy Kennedy, we're really trying to come up with a protocol for that. But if that is not the case, if it's a small employer, then I think you still have to go outside of it. Come to the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. Recently, the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund gave grants to, I think it was about 14 community organizations that are working in this area. So there are a number of organizations that are working, and we're working to make sure that they're better funded so they can help you. So there are resources out there. You may have to go to resources outside of your job, and you may have to leave a job. Because at the end of the day, your mental health and your well-being is a lifetime. And you can't let one situation, no matter how difficult it is, no matter how much from a financial standpoint, and I'm not asking you to just walk out and quit your job, but it is not worth your health and your well-being and your physical safety.
I also think that this is a place where, again, we, for each other in the workplace, we can begin to recognize who our allies are for each other,
exactly.
Right? Men, women alike. And I think that that's important, because we can look to our allies for some of the support and the help that we need. And whether it's just in providing, hey, did you see that? Did you see what happened? Did I interpret that correctly? Or relying on them in many cases to speak up, because again, it's harder for the receiver, the victim of the harassment, to do that. And one of the really interesting things about, you know, men who are watching and seeing and hearing these things go on is that research shows that we have a higher level of acceptance, of perceived acceptance of the other men in the room. And so we're less likely to say something or do something if we think that everybody else in the room accepts it. But the reality is that we don't, right? And so we have this, again, a little bit of education and understanding how we can, just standard by standard training and intervention works really well, and how we can do the small things, right, to help and to acknowledge and to check people to, when they say or do something.
Well, we are about to open this up to Q&A, so if you have questions, please line up at the microphones in the aisles. And while you're getting to those microphones, I just want to ask both of you, if people in this room could do one thing to improve the environment in their workplace, to make sure their employers are headed in the right direction, what's that one thing?
I would say if you see something, say something, just like they have it at the airports. I mean, it's not, and I also believe, and I think some of you, especially you who know African-American history, will relate to this. The great civil rights leader, Booker T. Washington, said, you know, throw down your plowshares where you are. Now, he meant that very literally in terms of take agency where you are, but you have some control, even if you don't feel like you have control. I'll tell a very brief story. I was in the mall, and I was on the escalator, and I was not walking, and I wasn't walking up the escalator. I was standing on the side, and there was a woman behind me, an older woman, you know, white woman, probably older, like my age, standing on the right side. So then this group of young kids, and this was in West LA, and I think they might have been Persian or... because there's a big Iranian-American community in West LA. And so they started coming up the escalator like this, like snaking through us in kind of a loud way. They weren't touching us. They weren't, but they were just loud, like teenage loud. And so as the last of them walked past us, this woman looked up at me and she said, "I am just so sick of that." And I just looked at her and I tried to do it in as non-judgmental a way as possible, and I just said, "It doesn't really bother me. I mean, they're just kids, and this is the mall, and that's what they do." and they were, there was a bunch of kids at the top, so they were trying to get to their friends, and you know, and it was very teenagey, showing jackets, and so she looked at me and she said, "Yeah, you're right. I probably just had a bad day." So I hope maybe in the next time she's someplace and she sees some kids who are just being kids, that she won't take it as a disruption, as they're bad people, or she won't characterize Persian Americans in a certain way. So I think there's all these little things that we can do that we don't think are such a big deal, but they are a big deal because it, you put it out there and it comes back to you.
Yeah. I agree, and I think... And I think it comes back to we have to begin to learn and educate ourselves and to understand about people that don't look like us, that aren't like us, and different cultures. And we have to find ways to do that. And I think one of the ways we can do that is begin, we can use it within our companies and organizations out there, if you have an employee resource group or affinity groups or different leadership initiatives, is to get involved if that's a group that you're not a member of, right? And that's going to make you, I would say for the guys in particular, that, hey, you've got to find a way. Hopefully a woman or somebody will invite you to maybe their ERG. And a lot of guys talk about how, boy, that just really makes me uncomfortable. And I said, it's time to get comfortable being uncomfortable. Know how the rest of the world lives. A little bit of that discomfort is going to go a long ways in your empathy and understanding the challenges that other people go through. So a lot of it goes to, I think, education, understanding, and doing a generous amount of deep listening. And the story I would give you on this is that when we wrote Athena Rising, we had a chance to interview some of the most successful, powerful women across this country and their male mentors in this case. And we never asked any of the men this question, but all of them came to this conclusion by the end of the interview that, wow, I think I learned more from her than she ever learned from me. But it speaks to that reciprocal nature about a great professional learning, mentoring relationship like that. We can learn from each other. And I think that's one way to approach it.
We'll start taking questions. Yes, ma'am.
Great. So I wanted to build on the question you asked about what companies are doing this well. So because I agree, I work for a very large global multinational technology company that's actually pretty close to where we are right now, and we have really robust D&I programs. And we're looking at this topic from every different perspective, harassment, retention, enrichment, mentorship, sponsorships, you name it. But we really see the opportunity and the responsibility for big brands to step up and come together to really work on this collectively. I'd love your thoughts on, based on movements you've seen in the past, what would impress you? What milestones do you think big brands could come together, lock arms, and say, you know, we're going to go focus on this? What might those goals look like? Because right now we're looking at a lot, and I read a lot of industry perspectives that kind of say mediocre goals yield mediocre outcomes. What do you think would really change the tide? And perhaps using examples of other movements that have really just said, but, you know, let's believe in the power of more than just one brand's, what everybody's doing within their own walls, and we could come together and what might really move the needle, in your opinion, to where you could then, in a couple years, say, these companies are doing it right. These companies had an impact globally.
Challenge each other to diversify their boards and their C-suites. I'm not so much focused on other movements. It's almost abhorrent to me when you say you want to make change and then you go sit in the board, and that board is not only entirely composed of men and often white men, but then often composed of people who are not, who don't have a world view.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen some board realignment recently in our own business in CBS, and on one hand, I was really thrilled at all the women who came on the CBS board, but I thought, what a lost opportunity. So you replaced three white men with three white women, and you didn't replace it with them with anyone in the activist community who might have really been able to sit in those rooms and talk to you about why your culture wasn't working.
So there's a great book out there, What Works, Gender Equality by Design, Iris Bonnet, I think is how you pronounce her last name, from Harvard. And the three keys that they find in successful programs, and this is from a, if you think about it, from a nudge theory perspective about how behavioral economics work, that how we can move all of these types of movements out there is they have an accountability measure, right? So we have to begin to hold ourselves accountable. And the only way we can do that is to be transparent about it, right? So we have to, everybody in the company and the organization needs to know, so what are the metrics? What are the goals that we're and so we can, and then we can look at it, we can hold ourselves accountable, whether it's quarterly or at the end of a year or whatever the progress report is. And something that we can, again, the accountability is really important. And the hardest part I think companies have is that they're not as clear. The clarity part is really important too. They're not clear as to why we're doing this. They tend to talk about it in a lot of vague, nebulous terms, and it really needs to be very clear and upfront. Everybody needs to be able to speak the same language and understand exactly why we're doing it. And then we can really begin to see how it moves. And I think the final part of that is that a lot of these programs fail, and that's okay, but we have to talk about our failures. I don't think we spend nearly enough time talking about, hey, what doesn't work? Here's what we did. It doesn't work, and we begin to share. And if all, again, all the global corporations would come together and they begin to open up their vaults of evidence and, hey, this is what worked, and this is really where we failed and missed the mark on it, I think we could really move the dial a lot faster.
Great. And let's
thank
keep,
you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Keep the questions tight so we can get to as many of you as possible. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, David. Hi, Nina. Quick question. I'm trying to figure out how to get more men involved in the conversation. I run a business magazine for women. It's like Forbes for Women. But I'm trying to get more men involved with the conversation. We're trying to present women in a different way, obviously, not just the super young, super white, and super skinny. Women are all over the place. We're all to age. How do we get more involved with that? How do we get more men into the conversation that we're all okay in the workplace?
David, do you want to take it on?
I would start with that. Is that Marine Corps General said that 8% of men that are out there doing something, those are the allies. They're the these are the tempered radicals of the organization. They're cultural insiders, as Deborah Meyerson talks about. They're cultural insiders who have an outside perspective, right? They understand the bigger, larger cultural shift that's going on, and they can, and because they understand the organizations, they can make change because they know how things work. Start with them. Right. Start with the people that you know who these guys are, the allies, and reach out to them, engage them in this, and make sure that men understand. Or and if it's not just about gender either. I think no. There's other a variety of, again, aspects we need to approach this from allyship, is understand what we all have to learn and to gain by doing this. And I think we all have to understand that, hey, we've got something to learn here, too.
And it's all about making more money, too, because the more women you have at the decision-making level.
There is a business imperative.
It's a massive boost in finances. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, this one's for Nina. First of all, thank you so much for everything you've done with Time's Up. It's really, really awesome and really inspiring. You mentioned one of the first important steps that women can take in the workplace is finding solidarity with other women. What advice do you have for a woman who might be the only woman in the room and can't find that solidarity with other women or with male allies in the room?
That I think you look outside of your company to people who do what you do and network in that way. You can't always, I mean, I have to tell you, certainly early in my career, not as much now, but not it hasn't really changed as much as I would like it to. I was always the only woman, and certainly the only woman of color in many, many rooms. And I really do feel, just as you said, that I had a number of really wonderful men who supported me. But I was determined to find the other women. And I've always, I don't know, I went to Barnard College. I don't know if there's any women college fans here. But I just felt like there's something about being in a college setting where you see, or an educational setting where you see women presidents and professors and all of those things. It just never occurred to me not to find my tribe, even if it wasn't in my workplace.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, this is for whoever wants to answer the question, and I'm going to kind of start off with a little bit of a statement. Also, I'm going to say my name is Michaela, and come find me, whoever the... I don't know what your name is. Come find me afterwards, because I'd love to talk to you. Okay. So one of the roles that I have in my current job is I'm an agile transformation leader, and one of the areas that we work in is really doing cultural transformation, people transformation. And in something as simple as trying to get a team to work effectively together and to get past dysfunction, there's a lot of resistance to that dysfunction because people have operated in a particular way. I see parallels between the two, and I'm just kind of making a connection between the behavioral aspects of the culture with which we find ourselves today with Me Too and male and female relationships. And one of the dysfunctions I see with the teams, which I also see with men and women, is a lack of trust amongst ourselves. And so I've read some articles recently that talk about how men may not trust women, and I think women don't trust men, and we don't trust men with our feelings, and I think men don't trust women with our emotions. And so the question is how do we move beyond that conversation in a way that doesn't, in a way that's productive and not argumentative, but then do that in a way that actually can kind of scale out, where there's more and more of those conversations taking place, and that the vocabulary and the language that we use allows us to develop some empathy with one another so that we can get past that lack of trust.
That's a big one.
Also, I said my name, Nina, because I'm gonna. I've got some ideas I want to share with you, so I'll post them on the Time's Up website.
I'm gonna ask you one to read David's book because he really does talk. You talk about a lot of these issues. Yeah. So I'm gonna give that one to you.
So much of your book is about these dialogues and how you have these conversations.
It's how to have
maybe
these conversations.
It's more practical. It's like how do you approach these conversations?
I think the trust piece is. I think you found one of the really important aspects about this is it really is about trust. And great mentoring relationships are founded on trust. They're probably not a very good relationship if there isn't a lot of trust there. And that takes time to develop. It doesn't happen automatically overnight. And so, you know, mentoring relationships are one aspect of that. And I think it's a very special type of a relationship, but I think there's a broader one in the workplace where we have to just trust each other as colleagues and peers in the workplace, and that's another conversation where we have to begin to get to that. And we didn't talk about it earlier, but you know, one of the things that we hear is guys saying today is, oh, you know, I'm not gonna close the door with a woman and be alone in the office with a woman. Or I'm not going to go on that business trip. I'm not going to invite her to go on the business trip with me because, you know, I can't trust her. And I just say to guys in particular, when we have this, because this guy's having the conversation mostly, that it's like, first, what does that say about her and women in general? There are all these temptresses that can't be trusted, that she's going to take advantage of you. And then on the flip side, what does that say about you or us as men, right? That we are uncontrollable maniacs that just can't control ourselves, that we can't be trusted, we can't even trust ourselves. So I think we have to have that dialogue with each other first, that we can begin to have some basic levels of trust that I think in the workplace we do have. And then I think as we get into the more important ones around mentoring relationships in particular, that's where as we get to know each other and understand our challenges and then see that we're invested in each other and in that, that's what moves the business too. The business imperative was mentioned before, that hey, that's You know, we have a more diverse group, whether it's gender, race, whatever. We find it at every level of the organization that's going to increase our bottom line, and whatever your mission is, right? So if it's profits, well, okay, your shareholders are happy. If it's better decision making, that's great. If you're working in the advertising marketing industry and it's more creative advertising, great, right? There's all sorts of reasons why we should be doing that, but. That's a great question, and it's a very in depth. I feel like I'm not giving you everything all in one. But.
Yes, ma'am.
You kind of answered a bit of my question with the previous question, so I'll reframe it. But there was a pre-conference webinar on this topic, and it was centered more around the idea of men don't feel safe now with this movement, and so I'm hearing. You kind of answered some of that already, but I'm just wanting to hear more about, you know, is that narrative dangerous? We're hearing that from the president down. And how can we approach that message by making women still feel safe? You know, so how do we balance that?
You know, I often think, I wonder sometimes, like, if we had a group of entirely or almost exclusively men, how many of them would be asking us questions? I'm so worried about women. And are they okay? And what are they thinking? I mean, there's just something about the way we're socialized that we care a lot about that. And some of the answer to this, which I know sounds kind of harsh, is we got to not care as much. We got to care more about ourselves. And I don't mean that. I've been married for 31 years. I'm not like, you know, some kind of basher, but... We have this default, which is all about, are they okay with us wanting to be paid? But, and I know it's hard for them to adjust to having to give up some of that power. I mean, I'm not trying to ridicule your question. It's a good question. I'm just asking us if we can all shift our perspective just a tiny bit to do all the things that David has talked about, and that all of us who want to bring men into this conversation feel is important, but also kind of like, there's a lot of people are not going to be happy. Mm-hmm. You know, when culture changes, it doesn't always change so that everyone comes out of it feeling like, hey, that was the best thing that ever happened. Mm-hmm. That's the way it is, babe. I mean,
I think the narrative is dangerous. Like, I think it's dangerous for us to approach it with,
yeah,
are
so
men
let's,
safe?
Let's forge
but, I mean, it's incredibly dangerous, but it keeps coming up. So I just wanted more about your opinion.
I would bring it up
that.
Too if I was in power and I was being constantly asked to give it up. I would be like, you know.
All right, folks. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. We have a hard out at 11, but please join me in thanking our panelists today.